This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's show, and I have something fun for you. This gentleman, you'll recognize the name. He was a big TV star in the 70s. He was a huge star on the BBC. He's had a couple movies and has a TV show out right now. But let's talk a little comedy with our star today, Kelly Monteith.
Hey.
Wow, the crowd's going crazy, Kelly. It's so great to hear your voice. We were just saying it's been about 32 years, but time flies, right?
It sure does, man. I can't believe that it was that long ago. It seems like yesterday. I remember the club so vividly, you know, working up there.
Well, we had the pleasure of having you in the club a couple times in the mid to late 80s. You were already quite a celebrity. I'd love to talk about your history in stand-up comedy and how it led to television and movies. But I got to tell you, I had lunch with a very good friend of both of ours, Steve Bruner. And he said, He said, you know, one of my standard questions is, how'd you get a start in comedy? He says, you have a terrific story about how you ended up being a stand-up comic.
Well, it's something I always wanted to do, but in the days that I started out, there was no comedy clubs like the one you had. So it was just wherever you could get a job is where you worked. And I started out in basically in strip clubs. The old strip clubs, not the kind you have today where they're totally naked and work on a pole. These were, I guess you would burlesque, you know, they had wore pasties and G-strings. And
right, right. In fact, at a lot of the clubs back in the 60s and 70s, stand-up comedy was kind of a break for dancers or in jazz clubs for the jazz bands.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I did band breaks, and I would go up between strippers and do a couple of minutes and then bring up the next one. And then sometimes, the band would take a break and I'd have to do like 20 minutes or so.
Well, talk about a great training ground, although those are tough audiences for a comic.
They were tough, but you learn how to survive up there, basically. You really couldn't do, I tried stuff out a little bit here and there, but for the most part, it was, you just had to survive. You know,
right, and a lot of audience interaction as opposed to written comedy material. I'm assuming they probably didn't have enough patience to actually listen to a bit too long.
Yeah, I didn't work with the audience too much because they were pretty tough. So I didn't want to bring them into the show because God knows what would happen if you did. You know, mm-hmm. you never knew. I had one time a guy came up on stage was going to punch me, and I had to deal with that. I didn't know until later. One of the waitresses told me, she said, that guy was coming up on stage to punch you, but I guess he chickened out.
Well, lucky for him or lucky for you, who knows, right?
Yeah. And then I worked up in Duluth, Minnesota in the winter, and you used to get these guys that worked in the open pit iron mines in Hibbing. They would come in, and you know, these guys, their brains were frozen, basically. So I had to deal with those guys, and you know, they would greet me with not too thrilling. I don't know what I can say on your show.
Oh no, you could say whatever. It's a podcast; it goes out. So the point was that the audiences, unlike the comedy clubs of my day, since the 1980s, actually it started a little bit in the late 70s. Where people were going to the club to hear comedy. So there was an expectation of the entertainment. You were cutting your teeth. You're slightly older than me. You were cutting your teeth in the 70s when you were not the point of the entertainment. You were the break between the strippers and the bands. So the audience wasn't there to see or hear you. And so you would have to try to command their attention and command the stage, which is terribly difficult.
Yeah, I had a lot of people walk out and people throw stuff at me and the usual joyous time on the circuit. But yeah, it was a learning experience. Actually, I started out, it was in the late 60s, basically, so it was really a while ago.
Well, you were actually working with your father before you got into comedy, right?
No, I was working with, um, no, I started out in drama school, and then I started out working for a comedy team in Vegas in probably mid-60s. So I was around Vegas in those days, and I used to see all the guys like Shecky Green and Don Rickles when they were just they were big.
Yeah, that'd be an amazing crowd to be around in the '60s.
Oh yeah, I used to go and watch them just about every night, and I thought, God, I don't know if I'll ever be this good because those guys were so good. So basically, I started out from there. I started out in Florida in strip clubs through an agency that I worked with when I was part of a team. And he got out of the business, and I went on from there. So
Steve Bruner was pulling my leg. He gave me a whole story about you and Phyllis Diller.
Well, I did write some jokes for her. That was my intro into the team that I was writing for in Vegas. So, yeah, I did write some jokes for her, but only one time did I do that. And based on that sale, that's how I started out. You know, that's how I got to Vegas, working for this comedy team. Then I stuck around there for, almost a year, I guess. And I don't think I saw the sun in that whole time.
Well, I mean, just interacting with people like Shecky Green and Phyllis Diller in those days, even if just their being around them rubbed off on you a little, or in your case, writing a few jokes for Phyllis Diller, I mean, what a great opportunity to test the waters.
Yeah, it was. And you know, I got a chance to see everybody in Vegas. To just observe, like Earl Cosby, and I saw Carlin when he still wore a tie and a suit.
Those were the days.
Yeah, when he was opening, and I saw, I saw just about every comic you could probably think of in those days. And really learned a lot, you know, just by watching them. But I knew the only way to learn comedy, to do comedy, you have to do it. You have to get up there and do it. So that's basically what impelled me to go to Florida and start out in this strip theater. And then I started working strip clubs from there. But I knew I had to get out of those. I knew if I don't get out of these clubs, I'll be stuck. Because I saw guys that, you know, that's what they worked their whole life in those strip clubs. And so then I auditioned for the Playboy clubs, and I got on there. And that was my first steady income.
Well, working for the Playboy company would have been quite a feather in your cap in those days. That was really when the entertainment of comedy was just starting to kind of get out of the strip clubs and get in more, you know, appearances on TV and get more in the mainstream.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to say Playboy Club was mainstream, but it really was back then in the 60s.
It was. And, you know, it kind of gave you a chance to develop anonymously because they were private clubs, you know, they were key clubs. So rarely did you get, occasionally you would get a review. And I got some pretty horrible ones.
Haven't we all?
Oh, my God. Yeah, some terrible ones. And, but it was okay. You know, you develop and you learn and, you know, you kind of develop your own style and your own way of going.
Did you get I'm just going to interrupt and say, did you get a chance to, meet Hugh Hefner?
You know, I never did.
Interesting.
Never once did I. Yeah, never met him. I was at the house once in Chicago, the mansion there, but I never met him. He was out of town or, you know, fiddling around with somebody, I guess.
Well, probably one of his other mansions. He had them all over the world.
He did. Yeah, and he had that plane, you know, that private plane with the bunny on the tail. And yeah, but those clubs I know Steve Martin thought they were soul-destroying, but for me, they were, you know, a place to kind of develop and mature a little bit. And not to mention that it was the first steady paycheck I had in the entire time I was in show business. So,
well, and it is important in comedy and in show business when you get that first steady check, because much like commission sales, the income of an entertainer, you have to really learn financial control and be able to bank money because you're flush or broke. There's no steady.
Oh, man. I remember being in Chicago in the winter before I went to Duluth, and I think I had like $30 left. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I went to every agent in Chicago, and I think I got an offer to be a Santa Claus. That was about the only offer that I got.
Well, you would have been a damn funny Santa Claus.
Oh, I tell you.
Well,
I thought, man, you know, I don't want to. this well, is about the best I can do at this point. But then I got a job in Duluth, and it saved me, you know, otherwise $30, I don't know what I was going to do.
Yeah, that's a scary time. What's interesting, our relationship when you came to work for me was really post a lot of your success. Didn't you have your own show in about 1975, 76?
I did. I had a summer show on CBS, which I kind of like to try and forget, but, you know, it's unfortunate. It really wasn't, you know, the people that wrote the show for me, they were all Carol Burnett writers. And I'm not, obviously, Carol Burnett. So the show was kind of designed like a Carol Burnett show. And it just didn't fit me. It wasn't, you know, we did a musical number, and, you know, that's really not me. But
yeah, that was kind of the standard in those days, more of a variety show as opposed to the very popular thing for comics to go into were sitcoms. But yeah, in the 60s and 70s, comics were contained in variety shows doing skits mostly, right?
Right, yeah, it was. And it was god-awful, to be honest with you.
Well, but that at least gave you a taste of show business, because I know that you took your experiences from the stage and that show in 1976 that gave you a great opportunity. I'm not sure what happened in between, but I know you ended up doing 6 years on the BBC, correct?
Right, you know, because I had the idea for a show that I kind of wanted to do. So after that fiasco in 76, the next couple of years, I wrote this show that I was going to try and sell here. And then I went to Britain and did a chat show because they were having American comedians come over just for something different. And I hit a nerve or something, I don't know. And then they had me back again the next year. And then the third year, they offered me a show. And I had the show that I had written already that I was going to try and sell here. And I said, well, let's do this. And they said, well, okay. Well, it was a sitcom where I broke the fourth wall. You know, I talked to the audience, and then I would take them into the show. So,
yeah, I've seen a few episodes, and it was really fascinating, especially when if you were to see that today in the 2000s, it happens once in a while and a little more regular. But I imagine back in the late 70s, that was quite unique to stop and talk to the audience through the camera.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was very different. You know, it had been done, I think, that Jack, when he did it, and George Burns, but I kind of had a little different wrinkle on it. In fact, I've got a little thing that's on the internet called Kelly Montes BBC Memories, where I show clips from the show and talk about what happened, you know, behind the scenes. And
yeah, and I do recommend that if you haven't caught up with the history and you're not getting enough of Kelly Monteith, go to the website, Google him, and there's some really funny stuff and interesting stuff. In fact, tell me if I'm right, Kelly, you were the first American comic, stand-up comic, to get a show on the BBC, weren't you?
I was. And it's, you know, I'm from originally St. Louis, Missouri, so it's so weird to me that I ended up on the BBC. I mean, it's like, you know, you aim for Burbank and you hit London. You go, what the hell happened?
Bad directions?
Yeah, how did that work?
But as I mentioned, I've seen a few of the episodes. In fact, later in this podcast, I'm going to share a short bit of monologue and skit by you on the BBC so the audience get a flavor for what you were doing. But you were very popular. The show had your name on it. You were on 6 years. That's no short time for a TV show. So you must have been fairly famous around London and those parts. And you won what's called a Silver Rose. Is that like the Emmy in London?
Well, it's the Montreux Television Festival that they show every year. And one episode from the first year was entered in. And we came in second behind Not the 9 o'clock News, which kind of ticked me off because they had like a whole list of writers and my show was just me and my co-writer, Neil Shan. So I go, wait, you know, it's just the two of us. How can we compete with, you know, 55 writers, for God's sake?
So I take it they got the gold rose and you got the silver rose?
They did. But, you know, it was kind of cool to be, and the fact that the BBC would you know, take an American comedian and represent them.
Well, they were recognizing you and acknowledging your talent and your success. Yeah. And considering it was the first year, that's really a great opportunity to build on. What was it like being a celebrity in England?
it was very cool. It took a couple of years to get any kind of recognition, but hey, it was a great sort of recognition. I didn't have people chasing me down the street like the Beatles would, but I had cab drivers who would, cab drivers would call up, "Hey, Kelly," and you go, "Wow, hey, how are you?"
Oh, and
you
that's
get a
cool.
nice table at a restaurant, you know. So yeah, it was very cool.
Some of the trappings of being a star without any of the headaches.
Very much so. Exactly. Very much so. And it was a very interesting period of my life, you know, for 6 years over there.
Well, I just going from, you know, doing stand up at strip joints and casinos and ending up having your own show, not only out of your home country, but to have that kind of success in a whole nother country had to have been quite an experience. And as far as I know, very unique. I can't think of anybody else that's done that. Now, that must have opened some doors back here in the U.S., though, once you were established.
Well, you know, I did originally wanted to take the show and bring it back over here, but nobody was doing that kind of show as far as opening, you know, breaking the fourth wall and all that. So I didn't get a chance to sell it back here as much as I wanted to. But
yeah, you think it would have done well at the time?
I think so. It was different. I think Shandling ended up doing a show like that on Showtime. Same kind of a thing where he broke the fourth wall and talked to the audience.
Right, right. Very successfully.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I know that after that in the 80s, and this was still before you worked for me, you did do a couple Tonight shows and you were getting some other guest spots here in America.
Right.
You were trying to reestablish yourself here, I'm assuming, once you left the BBC.
Yeah, you know, before I went to England, I did a lot of Tonight shows.
Oh, John. You did?
Before? Oh, yeah. And then when he left, you know, when I came back, he left. And all the guys I knew, like Leno and Letterman, and they wouldn't have me on.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think Leno wasn't very good at putting comics on, but Letterman seemed to be a little more open. I'm surprised that you ran into that. They might have been a little envious of all your success.
Yeah, I don't know. It was very strange. I did eventually do a couple of Lettermans, and I did a couple of Lenos in the early days before when his show was kind of struggling in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And then when he got really popular, then he didn't really put a lot of comics on. Well, I don't know why. But
yeah, now somewhere around that time, you started doing stand-up again, and I know that I was able to book you a couple times into my main showroom in Old Sacramento. I don't know exactly what year, because my memory's half shot as well, but we do remember having you, and you doing very well. I'm sure that we booked you through an agency, and knowing your experience and success on the BBC, I bet we paid a pretty penny to get you. You said you kind of remember coming up and you worked with Andy Kindler, you remembered.
I do. I remember he was the middle and I closed. And I do remember it. Yeah. And also Sacramento. Yeah, it was a nice club. It was a good club that you had there.
Well, thank
so
you.
I do remember it vividly. So. Yeah. And, you know, you had, you know, tons of people. I'm sure you had everybody in the business working up there at one time or another.
Yeah, in the early 80s, we lucked out. You know, we got people before they were really famous. Leno was one of them, Saget, Coulier, Carvey, Seinfeld, just name-dropping crazy. But getting Kelly Monteith was still something special. In fact, you might relate to this a little bit. Right before he passed, I actually had Graham Chapman in the club. For those that don't know, he was one of the stars of Monty Python. And who did movies and TV shows for years on the BBC. And it was, he was one of our heroes, and we were able to get him in. He only worked for us the one time, and sadly, literally months later, he passed away. But it was fascinating listening to his stories as he hung out with the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. He came up in that 60s, 70s, you know, 80s, but mostly 60s, 70s, rock star time, and that's when Monty Python was rocking it at the BBC. So he was already a celebrity, hanging with other celebrities, and just to sit and talk with him about those days was just fascinating.
Oh, that's great. What did he do? Did he do stand-up?
It wasn't stand-up per se. In fact, we actually had a few customers complain that they came out for a stand-up comedy show and they didn't get it. but he had put together about a 40-minute monologue sharing stories about Monty Python, getting the movie Holy Grail done, which wasn't easy. You know, some of the stories with other celebrities. We felt it was extremely entertaining. The majority of the audience found it entertaining, but there wasn't per se jokes. And I think that some people that came to a comedy club, kind of like we were talking about before, expecting to hear jokes and material, they weren't really ready for Graham Chapman talking about his days of yore. But we just loved it. It was an honor to work with him.
I would love to see. I'm sure you must have had a lot of Monty Python fans come. Yeah, I would love to have seen that.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe, you know.
Well, we made a big deal out of it, just like we made a big deal out of you, Kelly. You were a big English star as far as Sacramento was concerned.
Well, I don't think I can compete with Graham Chapman, but just to be, you know, mentioned in the same breath is pretty much of an honor, because I love Monty Python.
Oh, yeah. We grew up with it, and I used to do some of the skits. We still can throw out stuff. It's amazing. Now, explain to me, without getting too detailed, but how did you transition from stand-up in comedy clubs in Vegas to doing the BBC show and your own show here in the U.S. briefly, getting back into stand-up? Was it kind of that to keep your legs in the water, to kind of stay fresh, comedically speaking?
Yeah, and you know, things had changed a lot when I came back from Britain. You know, in that 6 years, 6-7 years, as you well know, you know how the comedy scene exploded over here, and there was a whole crop of new guys and new women coming up, that's one thing I like about the comedy today. There's the broadness of it, like the women and ethnic groups and all these different people coming into comedy and a whole different slant on things, which I really enjoy, you know, to see. And I think it's great. It's great for comedy.
Yeah, and I think that you're making the point that when you left, comedy was still a sideshow to other entertainment. And when you came back, we were kind of the rock and roll of the, you know, what was hot in the 70s and rock and roll was hot in comedy in the 80s.
Oh, it was, man. It was. You remember how many comedy shows were on TV? You know, the stand-up shows.
Yeah, I had a couple of them.
Did you really?
Yeah, just locally. But it was had a short series with ABC and the NBC affiliate up here, and we did a 1-hour special once for Fox. But
wow! But I didn't know that.
But it was you know, you had Evening at the Improv really got things going. But you know, before too long, there was 6 or 7. Stand-up comedy shows. And then it was so interesting, Kelly, because we had to shift from saying, hey, come out and see stand-up comedy, you've never seen it live before, to transitioning our marketing to, yeah, you can see it on TV for free, but it's better live.
Yeah. Well, so you were right in the thick of that. It's the whole thing when it exploded, right?
Oh, yeah. I got to tell you, I lucked out, Kelly. I rode that wave. As long as I could. We opened up our club in August of 1980. It was the 12th comedy club in the entire country in 1980.
Oh, my God.
And by 1983 or 85, there was one on every corner, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
It got crazy.
It did explode. Yeah, it was crazy. It was wild. You're right. It was like the rock and roll of that time, you know?
Yeah, and now for you, though, it had to open up some opportunities. Had you been writing all through this just to keep, I mean, is that what you enjoy, the writing or the performing or both?
Well, both, yeah. I don't really work with the crowd too much. I'm sort of I write it and then do it, you know, kind of a comedian. Along the lines of a Carlin or Pryor was more spontaneous, I think, than Carlin. Carlin was pretty much, rehearsed and scripted.
Right. He didn't do interaction with the audiences. He had stuff he had written. He wanted to get out, and he was a very talented writer and an edgy writer. And I think that was important for him to stay fresh and stay edgy. I thought of you after seeing your shows in the 70s and kind of understanding how you worked and seeing your bits on the BBC, that you were a writer first, because I know that, I'm not sure what year it was, but then you wrote the movie The Lousy 10 Grand.
That's right. I'm still paying for it, by the way.
What year was that released?
I think it was about 2004, right around there.
So you wrote and directed it, didn't you? And you starred in it.
I wrote, directed it, and produced it, and financed it.
Wow.
So I know. It was the stupidest thing. Well, no, I'm not sorry I did it at all. I'm really glad I did.
I haven't seen the whole movie, but I've seen bits and pieces, and it was very funny. And if you and the podcast audience, be sure to go to your local search engine for movies and check out Lousy 10 Grand. And it's A Lousy 10 Grand with Kelly Monteith. It's very, very funny. A little raw because you were doing it yourself, not a big multi-million dollar production, but it's very funny.
No. God, I used my sister's house, and I used anything I could get, you know. I made props. Good Lord, I just bought everything on that movie. But, you know, I learned pretty much, you know, what it takes to make a movie. And I did another one actually called Too Hip for the Room, which is also on Amazon Prime. So you can get that there.
Oh, Too Hip for the Room. I'll have to check that out. What's interesting is that with your television experience, did you make an attempt to write for TV in the, let's say, in the 90s? Or were you?
I didn't.
You didn't.
I didn't. I had a chance to, but you know, I'm not a room comic. You know, a lot of us guys that get in a room, the writer's room,
right?
And they all pitch and throw jokes. I'm not. I did that. Tried that once, and I'm not. That's not really my thing. You know. So I work by myself mostly.
But you were able to led you to writing a movie. There, that's no small task. I mean, congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. The second one, Too Hip for the Room, I wrote with the guy that produced it, that I work with. Actually, he was my cameraman on Lousy 10 Grand. And it's more of a drama than a comedy. So I've got some comedy in it, but it's more of a drama than anything.
Well, I just find it fascinating that you took all your experiences in comedy and as a writer were able to come up with something as involved as a script, in this case two movie scripts, and get them produced, whether you did them yourself or not. That's still, they're out there, people can watch them, they're going to outlive all of us. That's impressive. Something I always would have loved to have done and never took the risk you did.
I thought, you know, I'm gonna do this, even if I have to do it myself, finance it myself. I didn't want to, you know, be in a home someplace when I'm old and thinking, geez, you know, I wish I'd have done that. You know, so I thought, I'm just going to do it. So I did it, and there it is. And as I said, I'm still paying for it, but that's okay.
Well, congratulations, though. I mean, from an artistic side, and as a producer, which is what the role I pretty much took on, I was doing the TV shows, concerts, and all the stage shows. I always wanted to do a movie and never really got the opportunity. I didn't take that risk. So for me, my hat's off to you, because that is quite an undertaking. And for those of you that think putting together a movie from scratch, meaning, you know, getting the actors, doing the writing, shooting it, editing it, producing it, marketing it, I mean, you really, really have to be committed. And congratulations. I think that's awesome. And you did it twice. So that's amazing.
Yeah. Hopefully there'll be a third time, but I've got this other show, you know, the Easer show.
Well, I was leading up to that. I wanted to let the audience know that right now there's a show out that you're starring and you wrote again called The Geezers of Beverly Hills Adjacent.
Yeah, The Real Geezers of Beverly Hills Adjacent.
And I saw a couple episodes, and what's interesting is it's not a long format. They're short segments of a show that goes along a storyline.
Right. Yeah. There's, I think they're under 15 minutes. And, you know, Duback is in it. He plays my accountant. So
that's Bob Duback. We heard him on the podcast a little bit earlier. Very funny comic. And you bring it, as similar to your movies, you are self-producing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. My friend Paul Paul Dolan is the director and editor, and you know, it's a one man kind of operation. You know, I learned that actually in the BBC, because you know, if you go to television shows here in America, they have this huge crew and cast. You know, they have producers and more producers and another producer and an associate producer. Over there, I had like two production assistants and a girl that ran the office and my producer director. That was it. And myself and Neil, who co-wrote the show, and we would cast it. And of course, we had, you know, costume people come in, but they worked for the BBC.
Right, but I mean, what you're saying is it's a much simpler setup, and that's not only more affordable, but probably easier to get things done.
It is, you know, you don't need, you know, 50 people to do a show. I know there's a lot more complicated over here, but because you got a lot more people to deal with. I never had the network breathing down my throat trying to tell me what I could say and what I couldn't. They never said anything. They never looked at the scripts. The BBC, they never did anything. Just go out and do what you do.
Well, that kind of freedom, though, leads to some great comedic opportunity. That must be great. Now, for the geezers, the real geezers of Beverly Hills adjacent, tell the podcast audience what brought this about, because I found it interesting. In fact, my wife loved your scene about always driving with your turn signal on just to piss people off. Because it's so true, right?
That's right.
So tell me the premise in where you're going to take it.
Well, I want to do another series of it, and I'm going to broaden it out. I mean, this one now, it's just kind of me and maybe a couple other people. But I've got friends, you know, that are comedians that are, you know, around my age that are, I would guess, be considered geezers. And I want to put them in it as well. So I've got some, you know, I'm going to broaden out the storylines. Because there it was just me and trying to, you know, date as an older guy. And I had a couple of disasters in that. And, yeah, it was just, you know, I just wanted to utilize my age, you know, to a degree. Instead of, you know, trying to get a part in a sitcom or something, I just thought I'd do this on my own. And, you know, in my son's in it. So you got the other generation there. You know, he's the millennial generation.
Well, I thought it was really funny, and I thought it was admirable that you were able to not try to hide your age or what you were going through. You're really showcasing it in a comedic fashion.
Right.
For the podcast listeners, there's one scene where you're trying to look a little more hip and young, and you try on skinny jeans. And right. It was just hilarious seeing you roll around on the carpet, you know, hour after hour trying to get them off after you couldn't get them on.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But it's so true. I mean, what's interesting is it's a real thing that when we're our age and you want to go out and feel young and active and date and stuff, these kinds of things cross your mind and happen, and you're able to not only write about it, but point out the absurdity and the comedy about it.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm older than you, obviously, but, you know, as well as I do, as you get older, you don't feel inside. You don't feel like you're older. You know, I don't feel like I'm an old guy. I feel like I'm 40 or 35 or whatever. Just the same kind of instinct in there and the same kind of impulses that I still have, you know. So,
well, I think that comes across. I think you've done a good job writing, Kelly, because I think that you've hit the nail on the head in showing the audience through the Real Geezers of Beverly Hills what it's like to be older and yet feel and want to live younger.
Right, and still do things, you know, still create and still work. You know, I'm no way I'm going to retire. I wouldn't know what the hell I would do if I retired.
So. Yeah, me as well.
You know, I don't play golf, so what's left, you know?
Well, if you don't play golf, what's left is a lot of time. But
that's true.
Well, Kelly, you've had such an interesting career. Was there any good road stories you could share or anything that stands out that really helped determine your life as a stand-up comic and where you got, you know, television shows and movies?
Wow, there's so many. When I think back in the strip club days, I think those probably were, I remember I traveled for a while with a Puerto Rican stripper named Solito Lindo. I'll never forget that. She was crazy as hell.
Well, and you'd have to be.
Yeah, you would. And then I remember driving home to a stripper and a cocktail waitress who got in a fight in my car, a fist fight. I was driving him.
A cocktail waitress and a stripper were in your car. You were what, giving them a ride, and they decided to go off on each other?
That's right. I was giving them a ride home. They lived in Middletown between Cincinnati and Dayton, and I was working in Dayton at a place called the Way Out Lounge with a girl that came out, and all she did was shake her tits to Cozy Cole's Tops Part 1. Remember that record from the 50s?
Well, now I'm visualizing it.
Oh, it was, now her tits must be down to her ankles by now because the way she shook them, she must have destroyed
her boobs. Couldn't have held up, huh?
They couldn't have. No way. No way in the world. But the crowd would go crazy. They thought it was the greatest thing that ever. All guys, you know, they're all, hey, look at this. She's taking her tits back and forth. That's it. That's all she did.
Oh, geez, that's funny. And they,
I remember those two girls got in a fight.
What were they fighting about?
Well, we had gone to a party at the owner's house after the club closed. And I guess one girl was pissed off because she said something that offended her, or offended the other one, and about the boss. And she put something in jeopardy. And I really didn't figure out what it was. But they started, one was in a back seat, one was in front. And they started wailing each other.
And you're driving. That's got to be awkward.
I'm driving, it's rainy, and I'm on this interstate, and I finally got serious, and I pulled over, and I told them to get out, and opened the door, and the girl fell out into the mud on her back, and then I said, get in, I'll take it, and she said, no, I'm walking. So she walks across the interstate. This is like 4 in the morning,
yikes,
raining, and there's still traffic, so the other girl was cowering in the back seat, so I drove over to the gas station that was on the other side of the interstate that where she went to make a phone call, and I was looking up a phone call for a cab, and her ex-boyfriend happened to be driving by, this big guy. He came in and slammed me up against the wall. he's gonna kill me.
Oh, did he think you were involved?
Yeah, he thought I punched her or something or whatever and worked her over.
And this doesn't sound like a fun road story. It sounds like a scary event.
Oh, it was horrible. And the other girl jumped in front of me, between him and me, and pulled out a knife and said, he didn't do anything. And then she tried to explain what happened. So the guy takes the girl into the bay out there by the gas station and beat her up.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Oh, my. This would be such a horrible position to be in.
It was terrible.
Welcome to show business.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Hey, I do comedy. What is it?
Well, Kelly, thanks for sharing that story. And thanks for sharing in this interview what an interesting career you've had. And for those that don't know the name Kelly Monteith, you got to Google it and find out. He is a big celebrity all the way back from the 70s through the geezers, the real geezers of Beverly Hills.
Beverly Hills is good.
Yeah, and I just, it's fascinating to chat after all these years. For my part of your whole life, it was very small, just a couple weeks in the 80s, where we had the pleasure of having you on stage, where you did a great job with the audiences, so thank you for that.
And oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for all the years you've entertained us through TV and movies, and the stuff you're doing today, I think, is as funny as back in the day, but let's prove it to the audience. Kelly, if you're okay with this, I'm going to share with the audience a scene, so a monologue and a short scene from 1980 where one of your BBC shows, and I think it'll give the audience an opportunity to hear how you wrote and how you performed and what made you such a success. And thanks so much for doing this interview.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you. It's nice talking with you, and maybe if I'm up in Sacramento, we can have lunch, like you and Steve.
Well, you know what I'd like to do? I think we ought to get you, me, and Bob together in L.A. and do a comics roundtable. That would be a hoot. So
that'd be fun. I'd enjoy that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
well,
Steve, too. Steve's a great guy.
Good comedian. Steve Bruner. Yeah. We'll get them all together. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy some stand-up comedy, a monologue from a BBC show, and Skit from 1980 of Kelly Monteith. Kelly, thanks so much for doing the interview. And
okay, Scott, thank you.
We'll be talking soon. Everybody, sit back and enjoy the comedy of Kelly Monteith.
My wife just can't seem to understand how difficult and frustrating traveling for a living can be. In and out of planes, motel rooms, hotel rooms. I spent half my life in hotel rooms. You realize I once went 4 years without using a full-size bar of soap? True, that's all you get in hotels. You get those little miniature bars of soap, take a couple of showers, and melt down, break up into little pieces. And then it's an art taking a shower. You gotta cup your hand just right. So these little pieces of soap don't get away from you, bro. Because when they do, they're down the drain. And that's the only time the drain works on a hotel tub. Oh, it's frustrating. Now, this isn't a bad room, though. See, now, when I first started out, I used to stay in some terrible places. Little motels on the side of the highways in America. Just awful places. Always had great names, though. I found that out. Worse the motel, the better the name. Where are you staying? The Ritz. Be some awful place. The Regal Inn. Mice are leaving. They can't handle it. They look dirty for me. I stayed in one place called the Majestic Gardens. There was a crack in the bathroom wall with a plant growing out of it. Shreveport, Louisiana. Never forget that. Of course, it made no difference where it was because all the rooms looked alike. Couldn't be any place. The rooms were always the same. They're always small, always tiny little rooms. I always thought on a picture postcard of the motel, underneath the picture of the room, it should say actual size. It felt that way. You know, you walk in, there's a tiny little room, and you see, the first thing you see is the bed that sagged in the middle. You have this little thin cotton bedspread with the terry cloth balls in a row. Four or five big cigarette burns in it. And always a toenail by the bedside table. Always. I just picture the chambermaid putting a toenail there before she left. It was part of her equipment. She had a bucket, a mop, and a bag of toenails. If there wasn't one, people called on and complained. Hey, there's no toenail in my room. Well, you just walk around the bed, there'll be one there in a minute. Oh, I left a lot there. Took me a long time to realize that's what the bedspread is for. It's designed to cover up this metal bed frame that juts out, see? So that you don't see it. So then when you walk around the bed there, it just... Oh! Oh! God! Who designed that? I'll kill him! Hey, where'd my toenail go? There it is, right by the bloodstain. Ah, the hell with it. And you can't tape it back on, so you leave it there, right? Well, at least I'm going home tomorrow. Of course, that means I got to pack. God, I hate to pack. You know, it's something you'd think would become easier the more you do it. But for all the years I've been packing, or sent packing, whichever the case may be, I have never been able to pack the same way twice. Never! Sometimes I'll pack and everything fits just perfect. Just perfect. And I say, I gotta remember that so when I repack, it'll fit the same way. But when I repack, it doesn't fit anymore. I can't figure it out. I haven't bought anything. What happens? Does the suitcase shrink? Or do my clothes swell? I never can figure it out. Oh, it drives me nuts. See, that's why I hate those old 50s movies. You know those old 50s movies? Those Doris Day, Debbie Reynolds kind of films where this wealthy, sophisticated man would meet this young, innocent, virginal type and he would take her on this fabulous trip around the world, see? And every scene you saw her, she had a different outfit on. Every scene, different outfit, see? And she was real happy seeing the sights. But when the time came for her to show him the sights, that's when all hell broke loose.
I'm surprised at you, Philip. I hoped you'd be different, but you're just like all the rest. Interested in only one thing. You led me to believe your heart was in the heavens, while all the time your mind was in the gutter.
But
don't butt me, Philip. If you think that spending a measly £100,000 on me entitles you to have your way with my body, then you're wrong, Philip. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
But
don't bat me, Philip. You can't put a price on my virginity. I'm taking all my clothes and I'm flying home.
But can't we talk this over?
I'm packed and I'm going.
Look at that! One suitcase, 34 dresses, 117 pair of shoes, 16 hats, 2 fur coats, handkerchiefs, handbags, underwear, scarves, makeup, and 29 matching chastity belts. All stuffed into one lousy suitcase. Who are they kidding? I mean, look at this. Look at this bag. You know what this holds? Two pair of shoes and my shaving kit. And this one here, this is a four-suiter, which holds four suits if you're a midget. That leaves out coats and ties and hats and shirts and shoes and socks, things that come in handy if you plan to walk around dressed. Oh, I admit I do take too much with me. I really do. I've yet to master the art of traveling light. Oh, that's why I feel so sorry for those hotel porters. You know, those poor guys that have to pick my bags up. Now, mind you, I tip them double, one for each hernia. And I try and warn them, but sometimes I forget, you know, usually with dire consequences.
Hope you enjoyed that. That was Kelly Monteith from his 1980 BBC show, The Kelly Monteith Show. And that was a bit of his monologue and then a short skit. And that's how his show worked. It was him talking to the audience, breaking the fourth wall, and then they'd go into a little bit of a skit storyline, and then he'd go back and forth talking to the audience. It was really unique, different at that time, but we've seen it a lot since. But he was very successful in England with that. And here in the U.S., he's had several shows, several TV show appearances, produced and directed and written a couple movies. And now there's the new TV show, The Real Geezers of Beverly Hills Adjacent. If you get a chance, be sure to check it out. We want to thank Kelly for joining us today. We know you enjoy listening to the podcast. Thank you so much. We'll have another new show next Sunday. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.